Gonna get started just as we walk in the door. So welcome. I hope everybody's doing well on the first day of SEJ and that you're all rested and excited for the final day. Welcome to new workshop eight. This one is decarbonizing transportation. And we've got a pretty robust set of panels from the Challenge of Electric Vehicles, which is this first one. The New York City congestion pricing debates to public transit panel. I've just got a quick planning note. We're going to take a 5-minute break after this panel, and then we're going to continue on with one of our panels on public transportation. And then everybody here who's participating in this workshop, you chose correctly because you get access to lunch 15 minutes before everybody else in the conference. So you go get your lunch early, and you have the opportunity to come back here and wrap up the workshop with us. We have one of our moderators here, Caroline. She's going to be doing congestion pricing a little later today. So, hello. So now we're going to kick off the workshop on electric vehicles. And this is a conversation I'm super excited about, and mainly because of the great guests that we have here today. We have Leanne Randolph, Chair of the California Air Resources Board. This is an agency that's responsible for some of the most groundbreaking climate regulations in the state, in the country, and beyond. But perhaps most germane to our conversation today, the ban on new car sales of gas-powered vehicles by 2035. And that's driving a very big shift in transportation in California that you see every single day, and a really, really important piece of regulation. And we have Nick Nigro, who's founder of Atlas Public Policy, which focuses on electric vehicles. Atlas uses data to equip policymakers, businesses, and journalists with insightful analyses, and he's widely quoted. So thank you, Nick. Thank you, Leanne. Thank you guys for being with us today. So the next few hours of this workshop are going to be about, what we need as journalists to cover this pretty broad issue that I'm sure everybody, has some experience covering. And I want to start it off by, just handing it over to my co-moderator, David Verse, who's a reporter for E! News. Hello, everybody. Thanks a lot for coming. I've been on the EDB since 2019. I've seen a lot change in that time, and I would say that as far as except for the nerd world, kind of the popular question was, what the knowledge was about EVs in 2019 was Tesla, like it or not, and is any other automaker going to try to catch Tesla, and are they going to succeed? And that was kind of the extent of the conversation about EVs for regular people. And I had a conversation last week with this Republican activist in Savannah, Georgia, and I asked for her thoughts on EVs. And she just unloaded this whole bunch, a lot of opinions on me, and a lot of questions, a lot of doubts about, is the grid going to have enough electricity to power all these EVs? And electricity bill is going to go up because of the demand of all these EVs. And emissions. Emissions from the power plants are as bad as the gasoline that comes out of the exhaust pipe. And the batteries, we've got to worry about these batteries and the pollution that's going to create when they're mined. She was concerned about critical minerals, whether we're going to have enough of them. She was concerned about competition with China, and whether there's going to be whether we're just going to help China by rushing to EVs too quickly. And she thought that the government was trying to sort of force EVs down our throats because, of course, it's crucial to Biden's agenda to promote a whole continuum of an EV economy. And keep in mind, this is someone who's never been in an EV. It was just granted, do some talking points, but there's a lot of awareness out there. And what I've seen is it's kind of like this ever-widening spiral. Like every time EVs come up, it sort of creeps into more and more aspects of our lives, come to address more and more questions. And so what we want to address in this panel is like some of the breadth, some of the ways in which this is going to encroach on your beat, some of the ways it's going to come to your attention. And you were really solid grounding. I prepared a cheat sheet that I think should be in the Kuva app that give you some guidelines about sort of like resources to look for. And so to, as first question for Thomas and Nick, I wanted to ask them, what is the use for journalists to cover?
So much. I guess I would start with, there's just a lot of, that list that you provided is just, it's such a great example of how much lack of clarity there is out there about EVs generally, about the role of EVs in our transportation system, about the effects of EVs, and how the public is understanding EVs. There's a lot of sort of misinformation on both sides, right? You get a lot of people who say, they're just as dirty as internal combustion cars because of the manufacturing, when there's clear data that shows that actually, if you consider the manufacturing of ICE cars and then the use of the fossil fuels, that EVs are in fact better for the environment than combustion cars. The example of the question about the grid, as a former utility regulator, I can tell you that in the light duty space, the EV load is just not that much different than regular appliances. It's a little more challenging in the heavy duty load because you need charging stations that are use quite a bit more energy. But it's not that challenging to plan for that, just like any other large user of electricity. So I spend a lot of time in my role just sort of kind of talking people through these issues and making sure that they understand moving away from fossil fuels and combustion engines, it's not optional. We cannot tackle climate change unless we make this transition. Just like many other aspects of our economy, it's not optional. So I really kind of want to get people focused on sort of the practicalities and the problem solving around EV adoption, and less on, should we even do this? Because it's just not optional.
I'm going to pick up where you left off on this optional piece, because I totally agree with what Leanne's saying about where we are and what needs to happen. We're in the very, very early stages of a once in a century transition in this industry. I think we spent about $1 trillion buying cars in the last year, and it supports about 10 million jobs in the United States. And so it's a huge impact on our economy. And to Leanne's earlier point, the rest of the world isn't going to, wait for us to sort of lead on this. And when in around 2015, 2016, we kind of took a back seat. In the early days of EVs, we were pretty much right up there in terms of leadership from a policy standpoint, from an industry standpoint. But around 2016, when President Trump was elected, we put it on pause. And China and the European Union did not. And so in the last few years, we've done pretty well as a federal government and state governments to catch up, but we're still behind in terms of adoption, in terms of consumer understanding of where the market is, and the future of the industry is really at stake here. And that makes for really fascinating storytelling, in my opinion. I've been working on EVs since about 2009, right before the Chevy Volt, the V, that plug-in hybrid that looked like an engineer's dream car, but not the most attractive consumer car, I'll say. Hit the market, same with the Leaf, a very odd looking 75 mile range all electric vehicle, where, you know, Nissan's first advertisement was, you know, the driver hugging a polar bear. Like, not exactly the mainstream messaging that I think, you know, you want if you're trying to sell hundreds of thousands of vehicles. So that was where we started, trying to get people acclimated to a car that could travel less than 100 miles or a car that had two entirely, you know, parallel drivetrains. I mean, it's very, very challenging. Tesla came in and said, actually, we can use regular laptop batteries, essentially, and drive hundreds of miles and charge them pretty quickly, and people can drive them around in a, you know, like a normal car. The entire industry was basically saying, no way, that can't happen. And they were wrong. And so when we think about, to David's question about how do we handle this, we have to look at where we were in the beginning, where when the industry was a laggard in sorts and didn't believe that Tesla could do what they were doing, eventually they recognized that, in fact, that is how we can electrify vehicles. We can build long-range all-electric vehicles. And now we have a world where Tesla has a ton of competition. We were just talking about this in the beginning of the panel. It's very hard, I think, for Tesla to compete because all the traditional OEMs have adopted their strategy. And so now we're in this state where their business model has been somewhat co-opted by the other automakers. And we're looking at electrifying all kinds of vehicles that 15 years ago we wouldn't dream of, electric pickups, large electric SUVs. And, you know, that's going to lead to all kinds of potential accelerations in EV adoption. But it also is pushing forward some of the things that people probably didn't expect us to have to deal with, targeting these different segments of the vehicle market much earlier than we thought. And so you see slowdowns in growth. It's in part driven by the fact that the market is much more broad than it was probably expected to be, just a few years ago.
Wow, yeah, that's an incredible breadth of topics. And, you know, it's just a huge universe of things to cover. Just to summarize a couple of the things that I was hearing, you know, Tesla, are they going to keep up? Critical minerals and the supply chain, China as a source of competition with the United States. One thing that I didn't hear that I think is incredibly important to a lot of people is charging infrastructure and just the need for, more charging infrastructure around the U.S., around different states, in cities, to support all of these different cars we have, the grid. I mean, the list kind of goes on, and it's just kind of overwhelming, and I appreciate that sense of being overwhelmed because I certainly experienced it when I first started writing about it as a reporter, just new to the climate beat about a year ago. Just to narrow things down a little bit and to focus in a little bit, I want to ask a question about, what do we here as journalists think is sort of critical for our audiences. And I just want to ask the two of you, really, Nick and Leanne, what do you think people really need to know about electric vehicles? What are the most important things, especially this year? And another way of thinking about it is, what do journalists get wrong about electric vehicles?
I guess I would start with there's this that this transition is going to take time. And there's this sense of like, oh, if it continues to grow, but the growth is not incredibly fast, that's failure. Or the infrastructure is not 100% there, that's failure. And that's just not the case. I mean, this is a transition that's going to take time. The infrastructure is continuing to be rolled out at a rapid pace. There's a ton of variety of infrastructure. You know, when people think about infrastructure, they think about, are people going to be able to take a road trip? Are they going to be able to charge for 5 minutes? When the reality is that People don't take that many road trips, and most charging happens at home or at workplaces, or at the many sort of, you know, quiet level two chargers that are tucked around in places that people sort of forget that they're there unless they actually have an EV and start to use them and realize, oh yeah, there's actually a lot of charging near where I am. So it doesn't all have to be perfect instantly. It's a process, and it's a process that's continuing to move, and it's continuing to grow. It's a market that's continuing to grow, and these problems are continuing to sort of work their way out. You know, batteries are becoming more efficient. They're becoming more cost effective. The recycling infrastructure is starting to sprout up and get going. So there's a lot of growth in the industry in a lot of different aspects that are ways that these problems are going to be solved over time. And I loved Nick's point about a once in a century transition, right? We did this transition before. We did this transition from horses to internal combustion engines, and we can do this transition again.
So one of the things that's really hard about EVs is there's some companies who I think are very good at anticipating some of the challenges that are coming and planning ahead. And there are some companies who have been much more reactive. And a couple of examples of that are, one is charging. So charging reliability a couple of years ago went to top of mind for consumers and for the industry, in part because of what I was saying earlier about them adopting Tesla's model of fast charging and long-range all-electric vehicles. Once you got a million or so vehicles on the road, people started trying to use this infrastructure, and it wasn't Tesla's at the time. Most of it was by other companies, and it was being really tested for the first time, and it did not pass in large parts of the country. The customer experience was not what people thought it would be. And the industry reacted very quickly, and all of a sudden they're connected with Tesla. They've adopted their connector, and Tesla's opening up their charging network, and all of a sudden the charging infrastructure marketplace is almost entirely different because of that like string of moves than it was just a couple of years ago. So that's just one example. The other example that I think of is the rise of plug-in hybrids as like, oh, plug-in hybrids are back. Toyota was right all along. And all these other sort of stories that I've seen, you know, not just in the press, but being driven by the industry. You know, some of us think part of that drive was not necessarily because consumers actually want plug-in hybrids, but it's also potentially an easier way for the industry to comply with the rules that have come out from EPA. And the extent to which we're going to see where plug-in hybrids are is going to be driven largely by the consumer. And, you know, I think there is a role for that technology as a transitional technology to all electric vehicles. I just don't think that bridge is as long as some of these companies are saying right now. And I think we'll see how the consumer responds to that. But if the infrastructure gets better, I think people will probably not be as interested in these plug-in hybrids as the industry is trying to like make them out to be right now.
I've got a question for you too. A lot of people in the audience, a lot of journalists at this conference, either work in a specific community in some city or region, or they cover some specific issue. And I want to make sure that I'm sure in your questions you'll address a lot of these questions that you have, but I'm interested in how do you see these issues arriving on the ground for people, you know, outside of power centers, even in places where EVs aren't all that available. And this is a partial list that I came up with of like ways that it can appear.
Mm-hmm.
We can discuss those. I'd be also interested to see other examples you have. For example, chargers. You know, what exists in my community? What's being planned? What's needed? Disadvantaged communities. How are they being incorporated into vehicles right now that are expensive, where the charging infrastructure is still just starting to appear? Federal support for EV chargers. Where is the federal money going in our communities to build those chargers? factories being built all over the country, or most of them in places where EV adoption is low to non-existent. Electric school buses, which are, you know, appearing via EPA all over the country. Workers, are there going to be enough workers for all these factories, and what is it they're going to be doing with their time? That's just kind of to see some thoughts. Now, if you're looking at this from the perspective of a community, that's not that familiar with EVs, what things should reporters be thinking about?
Well, you know, I feel pretty fortunate because in California, we sort of have such a huge variety of communities in our state, such a large state. So we have everything from, the San Francisco Bay Area, where adoption is upwards of 40 to 50% new sales of EVs, all the way to the far northern California area, where you see very few chargers, to the Central Valley, where you see a lot less EV adoption because the incomes are a lot lower. We have to think about all of those aspects that you mentioned, right? In California, our incentives, both for charging infrastructure and for vehicles, have really shifted over time. At the beginning of this transition, we had a lot of on the hood incentives where it was just, you buy the car, you get an incentive. Doesn't matter, you know, if you might've bought that car anyway. It was really about just, you know, juicing the market, rolling out the vehicles. Now it's much more about how do we get vehicles into communities where they aren't as present. So our vehicle incentives are now income-based and MSRP capped. And our charging infrastructure, both the charging infrastructure that the Energy Commission incentivizes and then the charging infrastructure that the utilities are required to install, and the Electrify America settlement, all of those tranches of money have requirements to install a significant percentage of the infrastructure into our statutorily defined disadvantaged communities. So we really see the importance of being intentional about spreading zero emission vehicles throughout the state and trying to increase the visibility. I went to a project a few months ago that's incentivized by our cap and trade funds. That is a car share program in a public housing project. It's a fleet of Chevy Bolts. The chargers are all there. There's a contractor who has an app that, you know, sort of does a whole kind of car sharing system where residents in the community are able to use these Chevy Bolts. Those are the kind of things that we're really trying to build and grow. And part of that is about visibility. Part of that is, you know, EVs are not like unusual. You know, they are practical vehicles that are fun to drive, that will get you from point A to point B. There is charging available in your community, and, you know, go for it. And then the hope is that residents will want to, you know, eventually, if they do buy their own car, it will be an EV rather than an internal combustion engine.
Well, given that, just to interject and make a quick question or a quick point, you know, we have the opportunity here because the state of California does have this widespread adoption to, you know, discuss some of the challenges that we're all thinking about. California is perhaps further along than any other jurisdictions. Nevertheless, we have an executive order calling for 250,000 non-private chargers by 2025. That's next year to be put in place. We're at about 105,000 now currently. By 2030, we're looking at a call for 2.11 million by 2035. The Electrify America settlement that you just mentioned, there's widespread dissatisfaction with those chargers. There was a recent hearing at the Air Resources Board just on that. I think maybe I just ask, you know, how does one confront some of these challenges, even in a state that is, you know, so committed to this transition?
As I mentioned, you know, it's going to take time. And, you know, and part of it is just sort of addressing these problems and challenges as they come up, right? The Electrify America Chargers is a good example. You know, we had that hearing. As a regular Electrify America user myself, I had plenty to say about some challenges that I have encountered with their chargers. But at the same time, I mean, most of the sessions worked fine. People spend a lot of time talking about the things that go wrong. The reality is things do go right, but it is also true that there is, when I talk to people about purchasing EVs, that is the thing that they mention first. I am really nervous about charging. I'm very worried about charging. And this is actually a frustration I have with the OEMs, with the manufacturers. Because some of this is marketing and education, and they're terrible at it. The dealers are awful. I mean, we have in our Clean Cars for All program, which is, you know, it's our incentive program for lower income residents, and we have NGOs whose job it is to facilitate those transactions, and they will give you like horror stories about dealing with the dealerships and how difficult the dealerships make it to participate in the program and buy the cars. You know, so part of this is, and I feel like this is also true nationally, a few years ago, the OEMs were being much more aggressive, I think, and I don't know if you agree with this, Nick, in their overall marketing of EVs. And all of a sudden, like, it has really slowed down. And just like the most crude example, in last year's Super Bowl, it was 9 ads. This year's Super Bowl was 3. You know, I mean, it's just sort of like, I am concerned that, to your point, is just intentional, right? And all of a sudden, they're touting their plug-in hybrids. And the data from China shows that people tend to drive plug-in hybrids like ICE vehicles. They don't tend to charge them nearly as much. And so I really think we need to be pushing the manufacturers to recognize, you know, this is a problem they can solve. They know how to do this. They know how to sell cars. They need to be motivated to do more.
So just one on the charging piece. You know, when I mentioned earlier about the OEMs all rushing to Tesla's connector, which by next year, many of them will be introducing cars that have their connector instead of the previous common standard. That's a wake-up call for the Electrify Americas, the EVgos, and all these other charging companies that they really need to up their game, because now they're competing with the largest network, Tesla's network. And I think that's good in general for the consumer, because it's raising the bar. You know, and it's going to kind of be, you know, the end game potentially for some of these infrastructure providers as a result. You know, there's a very, very large federal program that was enacted as part of the infrastructure law called NEVI, National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. That's $5 billion. That's the single largest investment in charging infrastructure in the U.S. That has a lot of very high bar standards in reaction to the consumer experience challenges I mentioned earlier. Tesla's winning a lot of those awards now because they can support other cars. They've opened up their network and all these other things. That competition is good for the consumer. In the short run, it's going to lead to some challenges for some of those companies. In the long run, it's going to lead to a better charging experience that will get closer to what consumers expect, which is basically the same thing they do when they go fill up a gas car. There's going to be a time between now and then that's going to be, this company went out of business, this company sold their assets, these companies have merged, or this company has really changed. They've really figured out all the problems. And there's going to be a lot of stories, I think, that go there. To your earlier question about affordability, the biggest issue with EVs when it comes to affordability is getting consumers, and this is not just related to EVs, this is any efficient vehicle, is getting consumers to understand that paying more upfront for a vehicle to get more technology that's more fuel efficient is higher cost, but pays for itself over time through energy savings, energy cost savings. For EVs, if you buy a Chevy Bolt today, and you compare that with a total Toyota Corolla, which is not, you know, by any stretch a very expensive car, it's cheaper to own the Bolt in over like 7 years, effectively. And that is not just charging in the cheapest possible way, that includes charging in public the amount of time people expect to charge. But that's called total cost of ownership. That is like something that almost all consumers don't know about. And they certainly aren't thinking about it in the dealer. And when they go into the dealer, they go to shop. And to Leanne's point, that's where the OEMs and the dealers can come in and help people understand that much better, because they could say, they could be advertising instead of here's my upfront cost, here's my cost to own this car. And that sort of change in mindset is something that is very conflicting for a lot of OEMs, because now they're telling one story for EVs versus their conventional vehicles. And in the case of some of them, I don't really want to sell as many EVs because they're not as they're not making as much money. So there's a lot of challenges, I think, when it comes to pushing these OEMs. And that's why they're doing, in my opinion, that's part of the reason they're doing a little pushing back right now and trying to slow the enthusiasm for EVs.
One thing I definitely noticed this year is that when EVs appear in the headlines, it's always, are EVs good or are EVs bad? Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, EVs were selling like hotcakes, and EVs are good. And then Chicago had a cold snap, and all the Teslas were lined up at the charging stations, and okay, EVs are bad. And now we're getting this wave of plug-in hybrids, and Ford is scaling back its production plans for EVs, and so EVs are bad again. And so one way that we as journalists look at issues like this is we look not in terms of topics, we look in terms of tensions, in terms of polls that are represented. Mm-hmm. And probably definitely the biggest one we have right now is there's an election going on, where President Biden has basically made the EV a central calling card of his first term in office. And we have Trump, who's trying to find vulnerabilities in Biden's agenda by calling EVs weak and dumb, and helping China more than helping the U.S. And so I wanted to see, like, in terms of how do you see the polls? Like, what are the main tensions that exist in this election year with regard to EVs?
So I'm from Massachusetts, and there's a saying by former Speaker Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. And in the case of EVs, local politics is very popular, no matter where you're from. Particularly if you're from a red state, it might be surprising, but so much, about 75% of the investments that have been announced in the last few years since IRA and the infrastructure law have gone to Republican districts. Hundreds of billions of dollars in the clean economy, over $100 billion for EVs, resulting in upwards of over 150,000 jobs. Most of that's going to Republican districts. So you go to those states, Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, obviously not bastions of, you know, liberal politics or EV adoption. They like EVs a lot. They get up there and they talk about EVs. They participate in conferences in Washington, D.C. Governors do, talking positively about EVs. The problem is, from a political standpoint, in my opinion, is that it's being used as a bit of a wedge issue at the national level. I don't think it's true at the state and local level. It's true at the national level, actually, because I think it's been kind of dumbed down into this, like, good or bad, argumentation. I think that over time that's going to diffuse because of the benefits that it's bringing to those, you know, effectively new manufacturing hubs for the auto industry. For some decades, even before EVs, factories were appearing in the South, but they're appearing much more quickly. And in the case of EVs, these are the single largest investments in Tennessee, Kentucky, Georgia, in their state's history to help build EVs. And obviously that's something the state's going to want to support.
I'll give you one quick data point. I mean, the politicization, turning the EVs into a wedge issue is really concerning. And to Nick's point, it's not reflective of reality. Like, I was talking with a representative of Audi, and he was telling me that they have five fully electric models, and the ratio of EVs to ICE engines in their fleet, the highest sales, the states where people buy more of their EVs than their internal combustion. So this is within the Audi family, is California, Texas, Florida, right? That's where their EVs are popular and where people buy them over their ICE engines. So you're already controlling from Audi buyers who are obviously buying higher end vehicles. So I think it's really incumbent on us to tell that story, that these are cars people want, regardless of their political affiliation. So trying to get to drive that wedge issue is just not based on reality.
Yeah, and just to play up David's question a little bit, how do we get past that that good bad framework? Then I think you're touching on some of that, but I'd love you to think about when these tension points do come up, how should journalists better frame these stories?
It's hard because it's about data and nuance. It's not, unfortunately, there isn't an easy way to say, be more complex in the storytelling, but that's what needs to happen because, there was a story a few years ago about what was going on with Rivian's plant in Georgia. And I can't remember who wrote it, but it was very long form. It had a lot of great anecdotes and stories of people on the ground, but there wasn't a lot of data in the story to say what it actually meant for the communities that where all this money is going. And so you're left with, on the one hand, there's this money. On the other hand, some people don't like it. So I guess we'll see what happens. But I think the reality is, these investments in the manufacturing side are transformative for those communities. And there's a challenge on the one hand to make sure that these investments succeed and build sustainable communities. On the other hand, it's a necessity because if we don't do this as a country, we're going to lose that industry to other countries. Cause Leanne was talking about Audi from a, state by state standpoint. If you go to Europe, it's not a political issue. It's not something that's like, if you're conservative, you still buy diesel. And if you're liberal, you buy an electric vehicle. That's not the way that Europeans look at it. This is just something like some of the things are uniquely American.
Well, I was thinking one thing we haven't just really delved into is this idea of, when electric vehicles come up and we discuss the, critical minerals and the supply chain, this is sort of a new phenomenon when we talk about cars or car sales or just the concept of electric cars. We discuss basically, all these supply chain, human labor rights issues. And, as a journalist, I was thinking about that. And I think it's because we've been talking about electric vehicles as an environmental solution. And that's the shift. There's this way of thinking about passenger vehicles as, capitalism's answer to climate change. And we can debate whether that's, the right framework or not. But my question is, is that fair? Is that fair for journalists to focus on electric vehicles, on cars, with this new framework, this environmental framework?
I think it's absolutely fair so long as it's in context, right? There's nothing that frustrates me more than to see an article that talks about the impacts of of batteries and minerals, et cetera, and does not talk about the fossil fuel industry. Because I'm sorry, you know, when did the fossil fuel industry become clean? I don't think that's a thing. So I think it's just really important to put it in context, number one. Number two, I think it's really important to focus on the potential solutions and ensure or push industry to be talking and thinking about those solutions, right? I mean, there are companies that exist today that have facilities today to recycle batteries and to capture those very valuable critical minerals. So the question is, as you're thinking about these stories, you know, talking to the manufacturer, say, okay, what's your strategy? What's your strategy to get these batteries back? What's your strategy to get them to Redwood Materials? You know, most of the OEMs do have contracts to do that. If you talk to some of them, they will tell you, like, oh, this is how we design our batteries to make the critical minerals easier to extract because they have value. So it's really important to kind of dig a little deeper into, okay, let's talk about the operationalization of these issues and not necessarily just say, oh, because these vehicles use critical minerals, they're bad. And I do think it's important that, you know, EVs alone are not the climate solution, right? There are a suite of strategies that we need to be thinking about from a public policy and an industry perspective that move us away from fossil fuels and that address climate change. There's no one magic solution. And that's another sort of tension I get a lot of times. You know, people will say, oh, you just want to, you know, turn every vehicle into an EV and that's not enough. Like, fair. That there's a lot more things that we can do and that we should do. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't also transition vehicles to electric. And lastly, I'll just note that, you know, the success in the light duty EV, you know, the technology progression that Nick talked about in the light duty space is now happening in the medium and heavy duty space, which just has massive air quality and climate benefits. So this all builds on itself. Okay, I'll stop.
So I'll just say a couple of things about, I totally agree with Leanne on context. You know, it can be frustrating when you see someone talking in the public space about, you know, critical minerals and not comparing it to, you know, fossil fuel extraction, oil and natural gas and all of the harm that's caused to, you know, nations, people, and the planet over the last century. On the other hand, you know, I think it is in part up to journalists to ensure that the companies are held accountable. There's a lot of talk about, oh, you know, we're going to do it right this time, you know, and we're going to ensure that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. I, you know, that's one of the really strong benefits of EVs being looked at as a push from an environmental angle, because there is more attention being paid to where are these minerals coming from and how is this material being put together and what's happening in the countries where it's being done. So that's a good thing, but you do have to continue to follow that thread and make sure that those companies are being held accountable. The benefit of things like IRA when it comes to tax incentives and such, as it relates to these batteries and critical minerals, is it's setting up a policy framework for the next several years where the industry has to sort of follow that and follow that by building, making sure the materials are from countries who share the values of the U.S. And that's not a guarantee or not a slam dunk that it's going to be better than oil and gas, but it's putting us on a much better footing. And so it is up to journalists, I think, in part to make sure that that's being held accountable. One other thing I'll say is, from the environmental movement standpoint, these are a solution for sure. But environmentalists now have to grapple with critical mineral extraction as being part of that solution, right? You know, and environmentalists for a very long time, you know, have been against extraction and other things, but they have to embrace it to some extent for EVs to work, because mining is essential. You're not going to be able to build the millions of vehicles without it. And that's a tension, I think, that's present in environmental NGOs and those folks.
Okay, well, we could go on forever like this, but I think we're going to throw it open to Q&A. And I've got to read a couple of disclaimers here, which I'm sure you're all familiar with after building at SEJ. Let's see here. So question and answers are reserved for, but journalists and SEJ members are given priority to asking questions. If you do want to ask a question, I think you're just going to have to shout it out here. And I think that's fine because we're all journalists, so we're pretty loud. State your name and affiliation when you get a chance for a question, just so we know who you are. And just ask a question. Thanks. So anybody got questions? I'm just going to start with the gentleman in front of me. Please go ahead.
Hi, Chuck Kornbaum on Milwaukee Public Radio. Wisconsin is starting to get the NEVI funding application for being submitted. How willing do the states seem to be finding contractors and people that want to build these EV charging stations? How is that money going to the states? What's the situation that you know of?
Just making sure. So it's a great question. It's got a lot of actually attention I've seen in the press recently, because it is, I mentioned earlier, it's the largest investment in infrastructure in the U.S. And for folks who don't deal with state DOTs a lot, it looks like it's going very slowly, because it's taken the DOTs almost 2 years to really start to get money out the door. For people who have to deal with DOTs a lot, that's actually kind of part for the course. Contracting, planning, engineers love that stuff. And so those are all in the requirements for this program. And all of that is done at this point. And so the other thing DOTs are really good at, besides planning and engineering, is pushing stuff out once it gets going. So I would anticipate over the next year, a lot of storytelling in this NEVI site's up, this grant has been done, this construction started. And that's going to, frankly, continue for the next several years. And the little known fact, this investment, $5 billion investment, is part of the infrastructure law that is surface transportation reauthorization. That has to be reauthorized every 5 years or so in Washington. That's just now a program in reauthorization. So it's quite possible, depending on how Congress looks at this program, for it to be reauthorized and continued into the future. And so this NEVI could be a long-standing program, because it's $5 billion out of 500, essentially. That's how big the federal program is. So it's not a huge investment from a transportation infrastructure standpoint, but for EVs, it's critically important. And so to your question about how are companies, they need this money. And I don't know how many folks know this, but the charging business model does not pay for itself by just selling the electricity in a similar way that gas stations don't typically make enough money to be profitable on selling fuel. They sell a service, and that service comes with snacks and other things that people do while they're waiting for the charge. And so they need this upfront capital in order to get the infrastructure in place. And last thing I'll say, Tesla's doing so far really well with the program, because they have a much better cost structure than some of the other charging providers. And I think that's going to result in a much more competitive charging market, but it is going to make it easier for Tesla to sort of strengthen its hold on its charging.
And we're here.
So my name's Mary Landers. I'm based in Savannah, Georgia, and work for The Current, a small nonprofit newsroom there that covers coastal Georgia. I'm wondering if you all could talk about what is emerging as the best or the most popular substitute for a gasoline tax. How are we going to tax electric vehicles? Because it's nice in Georgia.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And we have not yet figured it out in California either. I mean, there's a lot of options. We have a pilot program that Caltrans is tasked with doing, which is, basically having a small pilot around miles traveled and sort of tracking miles traveled, and the theory would be that you would charge based on your mileage. But it's still in the pilot phase. Road pricing does sort of seem like the most logical kind of way to go, but there's equity challenges with that, right? I mean, particularly in California, where the real estate close to job centers is the most expensive real estate. So the people who drive the most are frequently the people who can least afford to pay additional costs. Of course, they're already paying those costs by buying a lot of gas. So we are really just starting to figure it out, and we have to move faster because our EV adoption is moving pretty quickly. I don't know what you've heard, Nick.
So this is a great example of a story that requires a ton of context, because I think most people intuitively think, well, we pay for the roads by the gas tax. And when you look at the federal level, how much money actually goes into highways, only a fraction of the money that is a gas tax is actually funding the roads. A large share is from other things, registration fees that everybody pays, general use taxes, obviously, that everybody pays, tolls, and all these other pieces of the pie. The gas tax itself, at least at the federal level, hasn't changed since 1993. So you can imagine how that's eroded. And there is very little interest in Congress in changing that. And so what we've done with that program I mentioned earlier, Federal Surface Transportation Reauthorization, is just borrow from other programs. So we've socialized a lot of the costs of the infrastructure. That might be where Congress continues to go in the future at the federal level. So the solution for road funding might end up just being, a continued dwindling of revenue from the gas tax. The state level, states have actually done a much better job of recognizing that a user pays sort of principle is good. And so a lot of states have actually raised their gas taxes in the last several years because they've recognized Congress is not doing it. The EV side, always important to remember, keep in mind that while they might be 25% of EV sales vehicle sales in California, or 10% nationally, they're about 1 or 2% of the vehicles on the road. So in terms of their contribution to the problem of infrastructure, it's a rounding error at this point. I think some of the programs to charge EVs probably cost more than the revenue they generate in some cases. So I think pulling it back, we have as a society, have to decide how do we want to pay, how we want to make sure it's equitable and fair, and what does that look like? And right now, it's just grab bag of ideas, and the jury's still out. I am pretty pessimistic about what people call VMT, vehicle miles traveled fees, because depending on how it's implemented, it might require a device on a vehicle, and Americans hate that. They've been piloting this concept in Oregon for like 30 years or something. And, it's just not as popular as it needs to be in order to actually happen. So I think, unfortunately, there's no near-term silver bullet there.
Gentlemen, I'm going to go ahead and ask.
I'm a freelancer here in Philly. I'm curious about the battery life, especially from a consumer perspective. I'm somebody who likes to buy a used vehicle a couple years old and drive that thing for as long as I can. And I'm already worried about what was the previous owner doing with the battery? Am I going to be at 80% capacity? And then in 10 years, I'm going to be at 50%. And from a wider perspective, I'm really worried about low-income people buying cars that are 10, 15 years old. Are they going to have a bunch of lemons if the battery capacity is way down at that point? So how legitimate is that or not? And what solutions to that?
Well, I can talk about the approach we took from a regulatory standpoint, and then Nick can probably provide some good data, because my understanding is that the data is showing that batteries are lasting longer than expected. But from a regulatory standpoint, when we adopted Advanced Clean Cars 2, we required, starting with model year 2026, will require the OEMs to disclose battery health. So they'll have a, you know, a mechanism in the vehicle itself where you can see like, okay, what is the health of my battery? How many cells are being used, et cetera. And the theory behind that, and of course, we also have battery warranty requirements, but the theory behind that is that the buyer will be at least be able to be aware of the state of the battery, but that only starts with model year 2026.
It's hard because the battery technology is evolving so rapidly. In the early days, they did. I totally agree with Leanne. They've lasted, this first decade, they've lasted a lot longer than people anticipated. In some respects, that's because I think some of the early vehicles were over-engineered to make sure that they really exceeded expectations. As we get to much more of a mass market, I think it's going to be something we have to really pay close attention to. I think from getting to this, how do you tell this in context? You know, if you lose some of your battery capacity, that doesn't mean the vehicle doesn't work. It just means it doesn't travel as far. And so understanding what that means for you as a driver is important. It's unfortunately, depending on the OEM, you might have a different experience.
We've got time for one more question. Ben?
Okay. Yeah. I'm a journalism graduate student at NYU. And I was wondering how you would respond to people who say EVs are kind of just a lesser of two evils, like not that much better than gas cars, that are keeping the auto industry in business and not really focusing on like a larger solution of like investing in public transportation.
I would say a couple things. Like as I was mentioning earlier, I mean, I do think it's important to invest in public transit. I think it's important to support public transit. But if you look at the number of vehicles on the road and how people get around, it's just not, there is just no way public transportation is going to meet every transportation need we have. And so we need cleaner vehicles to, as the existing vehicles age out, we need those cleaner vehicles. And I do think it is important to recognize that, you know, sort of, it's like the principle of not throwing things out, right? It's like, I don't like to advocate that you should toss out your car and go rent out and buy an EV. I mean, you know, you should drive your car into the ground, of course. We absolutely cannot continue to rely on fossil fuels forever. We need to start this transition. And so I just think we will always have vehicles on the road. And I think it's critical for those vehicles to be as clean as possible.
I agree with Leanne. The built environment is what it is in the United States, at least. There are places where you can live without a car. Where I live in DC, a lot of people don't have cars. My bike is my primary mode of transportation there. The reality of at least the built environment in this country is the vast majority of people are car dependent. And when you look at it from a climate perspective, from a security perspective, energy policy perspective, you know, we will need to have automobiles. Most people will need them over the next several decades. And for climate, they need to be electric as quickly as possible. And so extent to which you can make cities more car free friendly, is up to the people in those jurisdictions. There's a lot of local control there, bike lanes and all the other things that go with having a car-free lifestyle. You know, it's almost impossible to imagine doing that in suburbs, in exurbs, in rural parts of the country. It's not feasible.
And I'm also going to circle back to a point I made earlier about heavy-duty vehicles. You know, the light duty revolution is now incentivizing a medium and heavy duty revolution. And if you think about goods movement generally, it's hard to imagine goods moving without some amount of trucking. And so this will help those vehicles become cleaner as well.
I think we can sneak in one quick question. Sir.
Excuse me. New York, for example, has identified all of the major roads around the state and is trying in charging stations every 50 miles. And they're also looking at all of the bus companies, particularly municipal ones, and putting in charges there so that they don't have to encourage them to buy more EVs as opposed to gas, opposed to diesel. What impact do you think that would have on consumer regular EV cars?
Could we ask you your name and affiliation as well? That's clear.
I'm Roger Wilson, freelance writer.
Thank you very much, Roger.
And quickly, yeah, because we're coming close.
Yeah, that 50-mile standard comes from the NEVI requirements. You know, you have to, I think it's at least 4 fast chargers every 50 miles. So I think that's really important because it also helps with the visibility, to your point. Like, people get used to seeing, you know, the fast chargers along the highways, and that increases comfort level. And converting buses to zero emission is, you know, huge air quality benefits, huge, to your point, visibility benefits, that, you know, these vehicles are possible, they're there, huge quality of life benefits. You know, one of my favorite stories is standing on a street in Oakland waiting, and you know, I'm hearing buses rumbling by, and then I realize there's a bus in front of me that's very quiet driving by. I'm like, oh, it's a zero emission bus. This is awesome. So I think that's very important.
So final question for you two. I'm just going to preface this by just a couple of comments. So like I mentioned earlier, there's a reporter's cheat sheet available through the Hoover app related to this session, answering some of the questions about, like, for example, the NEVI program, the federal infrastructure program, what kind of legislation is being done by state is in there. It's kind of like my picks of all the best resources. So I would help you a lot if you plan to cover this. Also, just wanted to point out that to the point of public transportation, that is the topic of our very next panel. So if you're interested in public transportation, please stick around. So, show of hands, who has had an occasion to write about Elon Musk or Tesla?
Not that many.
Okay. So, it relates to my final question from the panelists. Elon Musk, best or worst thing that happened to you?
Well, let me start with, he was not the person who started Tesla. And Tesla was a genius move, right? Full stop. They took advantage of our regulatory framework that provides OEMs with the opportunity to purchase credits from other companies. And they basically said, look, if we purchase all EVs, we not only can sell these cars, and they made a cool roadster, they made a really cool car, but they also knew that they could take advantage of that income stream to help support their company, because they had nothing but credits to sell in terms of, you know, they weren't producing ICE vehicles, so they didn't have to worry about incurring deficits. They could just sell credits. So the fact that they figured out that there was a business model to be had from our regulatory structure was the real genius behind Tesla.
I have to just say that, you know, what Leanne's example was so good, because I've wanted to figure out a way to say this, but she's the most important regulator in the world. And that example is a really good demonstration of why, because Tesla wouldn't exist in part without that program, but also the federal loan program for manufacturing. And a lot of people don't remember that, but they borrowed over $450 million to support their factory from the federal government. And they paid it back early, but they still, that was a big lifeline for them at a time when they needed access to capital. So Tesla and what Elon's leadership, particularly in the early days of Tesla, instrumental in accelerating how quickly we are getting to an all-electric future. So in that way, he's an essential ingredient into, you know, defining how we got here. So if it wasn't for Tesla, I have no doubt we would still be talking about short-range electric vehicles and kind of crappy plug-in hybrids. So in that way, I think is a good thing.
Love him or hate him. Okay. Well, thanks, everybody. That's the end of our first panel. Please give a big hand to our guests. Thank you so much for coming out and joining us and helping us to cover this important topic. We're going to have a 5-minute break.